People of Note on Fine Music Radio is proudly brought to you each week at this time by Peter Turin Productions. This is Rodney Trudgeon welcoming you to this week's edition of People of Note here on Fine Music Radio. Now listen to this. Warby and Farrell are a British piano musical comedy duo comprising of Stephen Warby and Karen Farrell, internationally acclaimed concert pianists, but with a wicked sense of humour. They've played with the world's legendary and leading symphony orchestras, achieved over a million hits on YouTube, and entertained in over 150 countries around the globe, with what they describe as their barnstorming blend of sparky comedy and utterly sensational piano playing. Warby and Farrell are a four-hands, one-piano cabaret act that have performed throughout the UK and Europe in hundreds of theatres and festivals. They've appeared numerous times on television in the UK, Portugal, Germany, Austria, regulars on BBC Radio, in particular Radio 3. So to the two of you, Warby and Farrell, welcome. It's great to meet you.
Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.
Now, I believe you visited here before, but this is the first time you're performing. What happened?
I think we were actually on the Queen Elizabeth as part of their world cruise, and they flew us out in March, and we decided to spend a few days here afterwards, because they tend to just get us on the ship, and then we do a show, and then try and get us off the ship as quickly as possible. They know us too well, Cunard do.
So, they do.
And so we decided to stay out, and actually we put on Facebook a message out to anybody, look, we're here for 6 days. Does anybody know any producers that we may as well get introduced to?
Rather than just party for the 6 days, let's do something useful.
And actually, Dilly Keane from Fascinating Aida, who's a very good friend of ours, said, oh, you must get in touch with my friend Peter Turin. And so she said, I will send him an email. But anyway, we think she may have forgotten, because we were sitting in the Mantra Cafe, weren't we, in Camps Bay?
Yeah.
And then the next night we landed in London, and the email came through from Peter Turin as we were landing in Heathrow, saying, yeah, I'd love to meet you. If this had come in 24 hours, we were just 5 minutes away. So,
yes.
And so was it then quite quick that you got this gig now in
Well,
October.
Dilly said some really lovely things about us to Peter, and Peter said, well, if Dilly's going to recommend somebody, I'm going to listen to her. And thankfully he did, and here we are, we're opening tonight, and it's all worked out perfectly well.
Tell me about your show. I think it's called Rhapsody.
Yes.
Tell me a little bit about this show.
We give a subtitle to each show we do. We've currently got about three or four different shows that we're touring. We call the show Rhapsody because it's rhapsodic, so there's all different styles, and it's kind of as if it's made up as we go along, which is a good thing in theatre, obviously. But we are actually playing Rhapsody in Blue, the full version of George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue, and Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody, so we thought, why not call it Rhapsody?
We play the piano in quite an unusual way, which the audience will see. We've changed the way that people have thought of the piano duet, because we get ourselves contorted into all sorts of positions. And it's not a gimmick, it's actually we're trying to get the piano to its full potential. And so every piece that everybody that you will hear, they're all our own arrangements, simply because a lot of the traditional arrangements, we've found that they're not as good as they could be. So Rhapsody in Blue took about 15 months to put together, didn't it?
Because it was an unusual arrangement for us, because originally it was composed of piano and band, sometimes piano and orchestra, of course. But we had to make it clear when the piano would be on its own and the orchestra on its own, of course, both together. So it took an awful lot of work. And it still scares us to death. We've been playing it for a couple of years now.
It's good to be scared.
It's good to be scared. I mean, my heart's thumping as soon as we start it. But it's such a moving and wonderful piece.
And actually, it was really funny. When we first performed it, it was live on BBC Radio 3 on a show called In Tune. And Sean Rafferty, who's the presenter, we said to Sean, you know, how long have we got to rehearse this? And he went, 10. And we went, oh, what, 10 minutes? 9, 8, 7.
Yes. I think we were in tears with relief afterwards, do you remember?
Yes. But the other piece, Bohemian Rhapsody, the interesting thing was that it was suggested to us to do Bohemian Rhapsody, and we weren't big fans of it.
No.
Until we started dissecting it, and we ended up at the end of the arrangement loving this piece of music.
It's an extraordinary piece.
It really is.
It's an absolute masterpiece.
And we have such respect, and actually, I would much rather play a piece of Rachmaninoff than Bohemian Rhapsody, because it's one of those pieces that if you go wrong, everyone knows about it. So we
yes,
are
indeed. They know how it goes. Yeah. You can't just slam the pedal down and hope for the best, no.
When you said get the piano to sound in a different sort of way to what people are used to, just to clear one thing up, you don't use a prepared piano. You don't do anything to the piano.
No.
It's the way you play
physically
more than anything else. Because what I've seen of promotional videos of you and what fascinates me is how your hands are constantly going over each other. It's quite extraordinary visually to see how your arms and hands fling over each other's arms and hands.
That's exactly right, yes. People think it might be a gimmick, but as Kevin said, it's not. We're actually contorting ourselves into very strange positions. We like to think of the piano as our very own Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra. And if you have two hands on the left and two hands on the right, the traditional piano duet, it really does limit the sounds that you can get out of the piano. And a lot of concert pianists, of course, don't want to look stupid. But we look stupid anyway, as you can see.
Yes.
But,
I'm not going to say anything.
The shirts say enough.
And we actually are halfway through the first half. We switch on a screen where we project the image of what we're doing onto a screen so that the audience can see what we're doing.
Yeah,
that's a good idea.
Keys, yes.
And so, because particularly with things like Rhapsody in Blue, at the very, very end, the complication is that the piano and the orchestra are playing the same notes. And so we actually, and the audience will see that our hands are literally on top of each other, and it's a split second trying to get them out of the way. And actually, there's no point as writing these arrangements down, because you've really got to be telepathically involved with the person that you're working
with. Yeah, clearly you are, my goodness. But we're going to find out all about you and all that, but we're also going to find out what music you've chosen to share with us. And what is the first piece we're going to be listening to?
The first piece is a delightful piece of music. It's the main theme of the film Ladies in Lavender. I don't know if you ever saw it, but it starred Dame Judi Dench,
Maggie Smith,
and Miriam Margolyes.
Yeah.
And Nigel Hess is a brilliant composer and was the godson to the Queen Mother, a very, very talented composer. And we recently were introduced to it and fell in love with it, and we want to do an arrangement of this piece of music. So through a mutual friend, we contacted Nigel Hess, and he sent us an email just a few days ago with the score, saying he'll be delighted for us to do an arrangement, and he's quite intrigued by it. So actually, it's going to be quite special that we're going to start doing the arrangement. We've got the score, so we can stay true to his work, and we're going to start the work here in Cape Town. And so if ever we come back, we will...
Fingers crossed.
We will perform it in the theatre, hopefully, you know, where we're going to do the arrangement.
So. But what we're going to hear now is the original.
The original. It's played by Joshua Bell, and I think the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra.
Yeah, I think so.
So, yeah.
Thank you.
That's the main theme of the film Ladies in Lavender, that lovely film with music by Nigel Hess. The solo violinist you heard there was Joshua Bell, and it was the first choice of my guests, Warby and Farrell, a British piano musical comedy duo who are in town to perform Rhapsody at Peter Tureen's Theatre on the Bay. And I don't know if either of you know that Joshua Bell has apparently just got married.
No, I didn't know that.
This past weekend, apparently, got married to a lady that he's known apparently for 7 years or something.
Wow.
So there's something. I wanted to find out, you know, we spoke about almost the way you have to choreograph your playing, which we'll come back to. But I'd like to find out a little bit about your background, both of you. So who shall I start with?
You.
Well, before we work together.
Before you work together.
Oh, my word. Yes. Don't very often get to talk about ourselves separately.
It's nice to hear about you separately.
Well, I'm from a little town called Burton-on-Trent in the Midlands in the UK. And my grandfather was a very fine jazz pianist. He was in a very successful band. But then when he went off to the war, he came back in a terrible state. He never really played again. But what he did is he taught me to play the piano by rote. I didn't learn how to read music or anything until about the age of 12. So I spent basically my childhood addicted to the piano, 8 hours a day. I never went out into the school playground or anything like that. Entered lots of competitions and eventually got myself a place at the Royal College of Music, which is where I met Kevin. And it all started from there, didn't it, really?
Well, the friendship did, yeah.
Yeah.
And then it wasn't for... We had separate careers.
Yeah.
And then we... You were a solo concert pianist, weren't you?
Yeah, I did quite a lot of concerts on my own, but I found it very lonely on the concert platform. I always wanted somebody next to me, and I wanted to have a bit of fun. It was all so serious.
Yes, concert pianists, you know, it's terribly serious, actually, which
is.
I have to say I enjoy. Yeah. But I can absolutely understand. Sometimes you want the pianist to do something stupid,
yeah,
just for fun. And clearly that's what you two do.
Yeah, it's frustrating to be at a piano recital. The concert pianist walks on stage looking so miserable. They look like the cat's just died. They play, and they're brilliant, and then they walk off looking miserable. I just want them to say hello, at least, you know, it would be nice. Yeah. And some of them now are speaking to the audience.
Yes, that has changed.
But, of course, they don't train you at music conservatoires and colleges to talk to the audience. It's not the done thing.
Did you also, Kevin, start with a musical background family-wise? Or?
Yeah, I mean, my mum, I mean, the whole family loves music, different styles and that, but my mum went to the Royal Ballet School, and she won a scholarship to go further, but her father told her, I don't want a daughter of mine cocking her leg up on the stage, and there's a lot of funny people in that business, and to get on you've got to be funny yourself. And ironically, years later, I ended up actually playing for the Royal Ballet School. So,
did you?
So I joined the funny people.
As a repetiteur?
Yes. For years I worked with ballet companies and ballet schools and the English National Ballet. As musical director of the Jiving Lindy Hoppers, which is a kind of... They're inspired by the dancing in Harlem.
And a lovely name drop I saw here is you worked on that show Concerto with Dudley Moore.
That's right, with Dudley Moore, yes, who was my hero. And actually, how I got the job was I was about to leave the Royal College of Music and I thought I must go to the appointments office and see about if they've got any jobs. And I never worked out in the 3 years that I was there, I never worked out the geography of the college. So I thought, shall I go for a coffee or shall I go and see them first? I thought, I'll go and get a coffee. Anyway, I went the wrong way and got to the appointments office. I thought, well, I'm here now. I walked in. I said, is there any work coming? And I'm about to... And they said, no. I said, well, the next phone call you get, can you give the job to me? And so she came running... Barbara Nias came running around the corner and saying, Channel 4 has just phoned up. They're doing a show with the London Symphony Orchestra, Michael Tilson Thomas conducting and Dudley Moore presenting, the job's yours. And I am so pleased because Dudley Moore was a big hero of mine, and the combination of my parents getting me to drink some Drambuie as a 9-year-old, and I thought that at that point when my head exploded and all these colours, I thought we're going to be friends, and then watching the film Arthur were the two biggest influences of my life. So and with the piano and that. And so it was amazing actually meeting and working with Dudley Moore. He was wonderful.
Oh, I was a huge fan as well. I also liked his naughty tapes with Peter Cook.
Peter Cook.
They're really
Clyde,
naughty.
What was his name?
Yes, Derek and Clyde.
Yeah. Oh. We won't play them on.
No.
But what a character he was, and what a magnificent role performance he gave in Arthur.
Oh, it's fantastic.
So both of you, as it says here, are actually concert pianists, trained concert pianists, and know the classical repertoire and all that, which means what you're doing is therefore incredibly informed, if that's not a patronizing way to put it. You know about virtuoso piano playing.
We have both had fantastic teachers. I mean, your teacher was amazing, wasn't he? Had quite a life.
Peter Wolfisch actually saved himself from the Nazis. He was a child genius, and his wife was a cellist. Still alive,
and she's done some television work. And the Wolfisch Raphael
she's written a fantastic book called Inherit the Truth. Anita Lasker Wolfisch, her name is, and she was in the famous Women's Orchestra.
That's right.
And so, I mean, both of them. But the thing is that my piano lessons were really difficult, and actually I feel I'm gaining more now from Peter Wolfisch, now that, you know, I mean, he passed a long time ago, but I couldn't cope with him because music saved his life. And so where he was coming from was a very, very different pained kind of angle, but I really understand him now.
And there's also a name here which has a South African connection, and that's Yonti Solomon.
That's yours, yes.
Yes, he was my teacher.
Oh, he was your teacher.
Yeah, he was one of my teachers.
I'm getting my two things mixed up.
Yeah, what a wonderful man. Mm-hmm. I mean, very fine, very, very fine jazz pianist, fantastic classical player, studied with Myra Hess, the great Myra Hess, and sadly passed away a few years ago, a very lovely man, a very fine teacher. I always thought he was always too nice to me. I'd sit and play the Schumann piano concerto, and I'd think he's going to tear into me now. And I'd say, how was that? It was very fine, Steve, very fine. Would you like a packet of crisps? So he was too nice to me.
Okay, we're going to have another piece of music now. Yes. And what have we got in store?
This is a piece called On a Clear Day, performed by Cleo Lane. Now, when I was at college, they used to have these very posh concerts they put on for the soiree d'ors, they used to call them. And this one hadn't sold out, and the tickets were very expensive in those days, £200 a ticket. And Barbara Nias, who Kevin mentioned earlier, handed a couple of tickets to me and said, look, this is on tonight, go and see her, she's amazing. And I thought, Cleo Lane, I remember her, the one that kind of forgets the words and does all the scat singing, dooby-dooby-doo-wop. I went, and to this day, it was the best concert I've ever been to in my entire life. She completely captured me and my friend that went to see it. And she sang mostly Sondheim, which she sings absolutely beautifully. But her big thing, of course, was jazz with her husband, Johnny Dankworth. And it really was the most spellbinding evening I've ever had in my life. And when she sings On a Clear Day, when she gets to the end, she hits not a top C, not a D, an E, an F, or a G. She hits top A, above top C. It's absolutely stunning. She's got one of the widest ranges of a singer. And her voice is like, it's like a bass clarinet. The sound that she makes is just incredible. And after that evening at the Royal College, I went to see her many, many times, or whenever she was in the UK. She's still around.
Dame Cleo Lane,
that's right, yes. I met her a few times, and she's just wonderful. And this performance is just incredible.
On a clear day, rise and look around you, and you'll see who you are. On a clear day, how it will astound you that the glow of your being outshines every star. You're filled part of every mountain, sea and shore. You will hear from far and near a world you never heard before. On a clear day, on a clear day, you can see forever and ever more. It's a foggy day, it's such a foggy day, never seen quite as bad as this before. case you care to wonder why, I can gladly say I'm flying high in the clouds and behind those clouds here on a clear day. Ooh, you are on a clear day. How it will astound you, and the glow of your being outshine every star. You're beautiful, every mountain shore.
See what you mean, or I should say I hear what you mean, Stephen, that I know the clear lane on a clear day, and the choice of Stephen Warby, who with Kevin Farrell have the show called Rhapsody, which is on at the Theatre on the Bay, having just opened this week, Peter Tureen's Theatre on the Bay, and really dazzling people with your pyrotechnics. Remember I used the word choreograph slightly earlier, and just right, going back to your actual playing, the little bits that I've seen on YouTube and elsewhere, as you said, you've got to be careful. I don't know how you don't fall over each other or have an accident, hit wrong notes. Well, or have those things happened?
Well, just recently, I got my finger caught in Kevin's cuff, didn't I?
Yes.
So I missed a few notes there.
Actually, are you serious?
Yes, I did. Yeah, I don't know how. It's never happened before. My finger, I missed a bar or two.
When we first started, we were known as Cats and Jammer. And the focus really was really more on the comedy sketches. It's more about the music and our relationship now. But there was a sketch that we used to do where we'd play Verilese with the wrong hands. So that the inner hands would play the piece.
Yeah.
So my hand that would usually play the bass would be playing the tune, and Stephen's hand that should be playing the tune was playing the bass. So it meant that we got the outer hands free. So it meant that we could play and make a gin and tonic at the same time.
Yeah.
And then all the extra bits, the ice and the lemon and the umbrellas and everything would be inside the piano. And the audience used to just always go crazy over this nonsense. And then, you know, there'd be pork scratchings in the bass strings and all that. We were feeding each other and straws.
With the spare hand.
That's right, yes.
And so, and then you'd go cheers to everybody at the end. But when we were rehearsing this, we were putting the whole act together at Steinway Hall, and some of their pianos are worth like £150,000. And so we'd blank out all the windows so they never saw us actually putting this thing together. And the person, there's three of us that lived together, we all went to college together, we're all single, bitter and twisted. And and Scott used to drive him mad, because when we were putting it together, gin would be going all over the piano. And also we hadn't got the right level of the tonic, and so we eventually sorted it all out. That
in other words, doing an entire gin and tonic with one hand,
unscrewing
it, yes, putting it in, putting ice in.
That's right.
In
I would pass over the tonic, you'd take the top off,
all while the Firalese was going.
All whilst playing Firalese as perfectly as we could. Yes.
No, you're not. You're going to tell me you're not doing it this time.
We're not doing it this at the moment. We've actually been discussing this.
We were discussing it last night.
No, we're not sure. We might.
We could.
Is there anything like that? Because obviously, I don't want you to give too much away either. But I want you to make people feel, look, we've got to go and see the show, what these two are up to.
Well, you mentioned a prepared piano earlier. We don't actually put things onto the strings and prepare them, but we do some quite unusual things inside the piano, and we demonstrate how the piano has been used over the last 50 years to create sound effects and get all sorts of different weird and wonderful effects out of the piano.
We get a didgeridoo sound out of the piano.
We do. We make it sound like a guitar at one point, play a piece by Albéniz, the Spanish composer. But we can honestly say that people will have never seen the piano played like this before.
Is the piano going to be in one piece when you leave?
Yeah, I hope so.
Yes, you know.
They've got us a very nice piano. We played it yesterday.
We've only vandalised one, and it deserved to be vandalised, didn't it?
Where was that?
It was Highcliffe Castle.
Oh, my word.
I mean, they were so stupid. They booked us 2 years in advance.
Yeah.
And then a week before the concert, they phoned up. This is 2 years they'd had. And they said, we've got a slight problem. And we said, what's that? And they said, we don't have a piano. And I said, well, seeing that this is a piano show, I think that's more than a slight problem. I mean, we can try it without the piano, but we've never done that. So anyway, they got in this grand piano that was just looked like something.
Like an old table. It was awful.
It was just awful. And I mean, it was jangling when we started, and by the time it was, you know,
I think it was like an 1890s Broadwood or something. Liszt probably played that piano.
It was just awful.
We demolished it.
Yes, it was.
We did them a favour.
Yes.
Yeah.
We did the music world a favour.
But are you both or one of you a Steinway artists?
We're both artists.
Because we've got a few of them in this country as well, some Steinway artists lurking.
Yeah.
I think it's time for another piece of music.
Right. It is Mandela.
Are you talking about Mandela, Mandela?
Mandela, is that how, yes? Okay, yes. I'm going to get the pronunciation incorrect.
I want you to do it.
Abdullah Ibrahim.
There you go.
That's correct.
I got that right. Okay, then. He's a remarkable musician, and when I first moved to London, there was a lady called Marianne F. Grave, and she was from South Africa, and she was a composer, and she phoned up the Royal College of Music. And she got through eventually to a wonderful man called Tim Salter, who's a composer, and she said, I'm looking to employ a student to come over and record my music. And she explained what she wanted, and he said, I've got the very pupil for you, but I need to ask you one question. And she went, what? She went, do you have a sense of humour? Because you're going to need it. So anyway, I went and met Marianne, and something in me when I arrived there, she wanted to know how much I was going to charge her. And I said, I don't know why, but my gut instinct is telling me not to charge you a penny because I've just got a feeling about this. And it was the best thing because she took me under her wing and we had all the time in the world. I recorded her music. She introduced me to a lot of South African music. And this piece really stuck out. And it is a fine example. It typifies South African jazz, the rhythm and everything. It's that kind of cross between the traditional jazz and minimalism. And I've always felt, ever since meeting Marianne, fingers have been pointing towards, for me, at Cape Town. So it's really quite special being here.
And to sharing this with us while you're in Cape Town. So
it's
thank
just
you.
So, yeah, I love this piece of music. Thank you.
Well, that's a famous, I think, even iconic piece of music for us here in South Africa and clearly internationally, Abdullah Ibrahim and his song Mandela. A choice of my two guests on People of Note this week, Kevin Farrell and Stephen Warby, whose show Rhapsody is on at the Theatre on the Bay. Peter Tureen brought them out here to entertain us with your piano pyrotechnics, your sense of humour. How did you discover you had the same sense of humour? Because a sense of humour is quite an individual thing. And clearly you work together very well. I've read everywhere how you clicked.
It was a really strange night. I lived in King's Cross. And Kevin and I, after college, went our separate ways. Kevin was a film composer, weren't you?
Yes, I wrote music for some of the worst films ever made. In fact, we found one of them in the bargain bin, didn't we?
In Guatemala. We really did. It was a crowning moment for you.
I felt I'd arrived seeing this film.
What was the film called?
It's called Never Play With the Dead. Great advice. yeah, it's one of the worst films. Although there was actually another film that I did the music. I tried to treat all the films with the respect I felt that they deserved, which actually, looking at them, they didn't deserve any of respect. But there was a far worse film called Slayers that I actually was so badly acted, I turned the volume down whilst I was composing the music score. Yeah, so
we're going off on a tangent, aren't we?
Yes, sorry, I go off. Yes, so that's
I did some solo concerts and so forth, but we would meet. Whenever we arranged to meet, we would make sure we never cancelled each other, even if it was once a year. So, I was living in King's Cross, Kevin came over, and we accidentally got locked in the flat. I mean, we couldn't leave because the person had taken the key. So we thought, well, we're going to have to stay in. I had two grand pianos. We sat at the pianos, had lots and lots of wine, and started playing together, and it was like a magic moment. We had the same sense of humour. We improvised in the same way. We just spent the whole evening laughing, didn't we?
And this was purely spontaneous.
Yeah.
It hadn't happened before.
And
really,
it was just, we thought we've really got something here, and that's what led us to do a charity event, wasn't it? 20 minutes. Event with David Soul.
Well, we got Dave. I'd been David Soul's musical director, and I've known David for many, many years. And actually, they were looking for a celebrity person for the beginning of this charity called Mad About Art. So they looked for various people. And so I said to the organisers, look, you know, I could ask my friend David Soul. And they went, what? You know David Soul? And of course, I know David, so I don't really consider him, you know, as famous as, you know. And so anyway, of course, David said he would do it. And so we put on this big show for the launch of the charity. It was a huge success. But because it was a corporate event, most people weren't listening to the various acts that were getting up. And Stephen and I got up and did a sketch for about 12 minutes. And the place just went into uproar. And we realised then that night that we'd actually fallen upon something. And from then on, just something took over, didn't
it? Yeah, we created the act. And we called ourselves, as Kevin said earlier, Cats and Jammer. Cats and Jammer Kids were very famous in the New York Times in the 1890s. Right. The first cartoon
Naughty
strip.
Little children.
They were, and we thought it kind of suited us. So it,
but we realised we'd come up with the wrong name when we actually were touring Germany. And in German, the translation is literally misery and depression.
So, so that didn't go down so well in Germany. So
we eventually changed the name.
Warby and Farrow. Now we sound like a firm of solicitors, don't we?
You do, actually. I quoted that. Come and see the firm of solicitors performing at Theatre on the Bay.
Yes.
And so, and then you started doing shows, and did it sort of rocket up?
It just went crazy. We were looking for a venue, and we couldn't. And we went across to see a friend that was selling publicity at the Royal Opera House, and she said, "Why don't you do it here?" So our first gig was at the Royal Opera House, and our friends couldn't believe it. The place, you know, was packed. And
we had it filmed by the Kevin's film company that made those awful films.
Yeah, Screen Partners. And they actually did a very good job. We sent this DVD out, Cats and Jammer, live at the Royal Opera House. American Booker thought we were already very famous because it was Royal Opera House.
And the work came flooding
and
in.
And we had a year's worth of work.
Including the maiden voyage of the Queen Mary. We were talking about ships.
Yes. That must have been quite an experience, because that's an iconic ship.
Yeah.
We've seen it in Cape Town.
Yeah.
And it must have been great to be on there as entertainers.
It was amazing.
We were headliners, and actually, I mean, we felt so fraudulent, because the people that were representing the UK was Shirley Bassey, John Martin, who is the comedy writer for Ken Dodd, and ourselves.
Wow.
And so we did feel fraudulent. But we've been back many times, and I love that ship. It's incredible.
We're regulars on Cunard Line. We love it.
How long does it take you to put a show together? I know earlier you said it took 14 months to arrange Rhapsody in Blue.
Yeah.
But you also, I think, hinted earlier you have a different sort of show for each country you go to.
Yeah, you have to change it wherever you play. For example, we would do a very different show in South Korea than we would in, for example, Canada. When we play in South Korea, of course, in Seoul, most people speak English. The young people speak English. In the South, in Busan and so forth, you know, it basically ends up being a Korean lesson for us and a concert for them. So, you know, we change
and
it.
When you play in North Korea?
No, we haven't yet.
We've done that yet.
We would do, of course.
Right. I'd like to take him a block of cheese.
He loves his cheese, doesn't he?
Apparently, yes.
Okay, so what we are seeing is an international show,
yes.
But you kind of maybe even adapted it a bit for Africa, South Africa.
Well, I don't think we're actually going to change anything, because all the point of reference is, I mean, in fact, the country we changed it most for is America.
Oh, that's interesting.
It's, you know, but I don't think there's going to be any changes for South Africa.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Tell me about your next piece of music, gentlemen.
Now, this is Concerto for Phyllis and Cyril. That's Phyllis Selleck and Cyril Smith, both sadly departed now. Phyllis Selleck was my piano teacher, my main piano teacher at the Royal College. They were both very, very famous in the 50s, 60s and 70s as duettists. Cyril had a stroke whilst they were touring Russia in the 50s, and they became very, very famous three-handed piano duo.
Oh, okay.
So lots of famous composers wrote music for them, such as Vaughan Williams, and this one was written by Malcolm Arnold. And it's an absolutely beautiful piece. It's quite a short concerto. The slow movement is absolutely stunning. It sounds almost Ravelian. It's just so beautiful. And we've been fortunate to play it a couple of times with the Brighton Philharmonic Orchestra. And this performance that we're going to play is us playing it with James Blair and the Young Musicians Symphony Orchestra.
And we rearranged it, didn't we?
Yeah, we arranged it. It's the longest title ever. Concerto for Phyllis and Cyril, three hands, two pianos. We've arranged it for one piano, four hands.
Ah, okay.
And we've stayed very good to the score. So I once met Malcolm Arnold. I'd love for him to have heard this performance. I think he would have loved it.
There you are. Now you've heard my two guests playing. You said that was a long title, Stephen. What was it? I can't remember.
Naughty.
What's the title?
It's Concerto for Phyllis and Cyril for three hands, two pianos. We renamed it Concerto for Phyllis and Cyril, arranged for one piano, four hands. There we go. How's that?
Would it be interesting actually to see, you know, one gets used to the left-hand concertos.
Yeah.
I hate watching them because you always think at any moment they're going to pick up their right arm and it will go horribly wrong. Yes. But three hands would be interesting. But we've got four hands here, and it's interesting that you've chosen one piano. And by the way, why did you do that? Why didn't you have two pianos? Wouldn't it have made it easier for you?
Well, you know, when we put the act together in my flat in King's Cross, we have two pianos there.
Yeah.
But then we suddenly thought, well, most theatres only have one piano. Why make things difficult for ourselves?
How considerate of you.
Yes. And when we sat together at the piano, it's more special for us anyway. We think together. And when we sat looking at each other on two pianos, it just doesn't work.
The arrangements don't work on two pianos.
No.
You get a bigger sound on the one piano.
Indeed. But also there's lots of climbing over each other, as I've said. There's lots of physical work.
Yeah.
Hence me using that choreograph.
I mean, we're used to it, and it's quite funny that people are fascinated by it because it's just a second language to us, and we actually have to be careful and have to remember whether we're going over or under, you know. But it is just to get the right sounds, you know. That's the reason why we do it.
Mm-hmm. And is there a fair amount of dialogue? Do you tell jokes and things?
Oh, we talk a lot to the audience. Yes, we love to make friends with the audience. It's not just piano playing. Yeah. That's the biggest part.
In fact, the first thing we do is we come on and start chatting to the audience.
Yes.
Then we introduce the piano and then we introduce the screen.
Yeah, that's right.
And then we're away.
Yes.
And now, because we're coming towards the end of the show, you're back in Cape Town after your Cunard visit earlier this year. But now, with a show like this, and I like asking guests this, are you going to have a chance to sample some of our fine wines and cuisine?
Oh, my word, yes.
We already have.
Oh, we already have.
Have you?
Yes.
I mean, I love the wines out here. I mean, the Stellenbosch is the... What was it? Twilight Rustenburg as well. We had some Chenin Blanc.
Last night we had a couple of glasses. Yes.
A couple.
We have to be, you know, if you perform
well,
the next day.
Yes,
we call it school night. You know, we have to be careful. If we weren't performing, then we'd be all over the
place. But there's always afterwards. And isn't that a beautiful setting where you are?
Oh, yes. Gorgeous. Yeah,
yes,
absolutely stunning.
So now when you leave South Africa, what then? Do you have a whole itinerary can you relax a while?
No, we go straight back to London. We're being interviewed by the BBC, aren't we?
And then we're obviously coming back to
Johannesburg. We're doing
Easterine's Monte Cassino.
We're doing the Monte Cassino. Yeah.
Oh, this show for Peter.
Yeah.
Yep.
We come straight back. And then we go back to the UK and we immediately perform our brand new show, this year's show that hopefully we might bring back here at some point, called Masquerade. We perform that at the Usher Hall, which is Edinburgh's Albert Hall.
Mm.
And then a few days later, we fly straight to Barbados to pick up the Queen Mary to do a show on there to New York.
Oh, my God.
And then we spend a few days in New York, don't we?
And then New York. We love New York. Yes.
Oh, really? Have you performed in New York?
No, we haven't, actually. We were asked to do a place called 54 Below, but it didn't work out.
We didn't get the time slot that we thought would be best, so we're going to hang out for that. They wanted to give us the 11 o'clock at night slot.
We wouldn't even know our own names by that time, would we? Yeah.
Too drunk by then.
Yes.
So there's no point.
Oh, well, maybe I'll see you on the Queen Mary 2 one day.
That would be great.
One of my wishes of that is to do that Atlantic crossing. Imagine that.
Oh, they're so special.
It's the best.
And imagine if you're on the ship and I'm there. Gosh.
Wouldn't
we can have a cup of tea or two.
Oh, we could. And a cream horn.
Okay, gentlemen, it's been lovely talking to you. I'm so looking forward to your show. I haven't seen the show yet, although I'm going later this week. But I hope you have a fantastic run.
Thank you very much.
As though it's an absolute joy.
Thank you.
I hope you have a fantastic run, and I hope you come back and play us Fur Elise.
Mm.
Okay.
What is your last piece?
Actually, it's Vidor's Toccata. But we set it to a dance track with James Herr. James Herr is one of the leading music kind of dance producers in Europe. And we've worked with him before, and we decided to turn this wonderful piece of music into a dance track. And it worked beautifully.
Am I going to like it?
This is very different to the rest of them.
Yeah.
We're so proud of this.
And it's you great. Playing.
It's us playing.
It's us playing.
Yeah. I've been talking to Kevin Farrell and Stephen Warby. Their show, Warby and Farrell, called Rhapsody, is on at the Theatre on the Bay, Peter Tureen's Theatre on the Bay. Gentlemen, thank you and hope to see you again.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
People of Note on Fine Music Radio was proudly brought to you by Peter Turin Productions. This October, Theatre on the Bay invites you to enjoy a night of exhilarating rhapsodies and comedy mayhem with Warby and Farrell's Rhapsody. Enter a world of sensational piano playing direct from the UK in what promises to be a fabulous night at the theatre from the 8th to the 19th of October. From Liszt to Jules Holland, Queen to Gershwin, come and revel in their barnstorming blend of sparkling comedy. That's Warby and Farrell's Rhapsody from the 8th to the 19th of October, only at Theatre on the Bay. Book now.